particularly catatonic patient, he had been lobectomized many years ago, could sit immobile for hours on end and served as a backrest for one of the therapists, as she sat on the burnt grass, her back resting comfortably against his as she did her knitting. He was called Sidney, and he was famous for having enormous genitals. I had been summoned by the other nurses at washing time on my very first day at work to admire Sidney's equipment as he lay catatonically in the bath. It was while working here that I first came across the name of the famous neurosurgical hospital where I was to train and eventually become the senior consultant neurosurgeon myself. In the 1950s, many of the patients I was now looking after, like the catatonic Sidney, had been sent to that hospital and subjected to the psychosurgical procedure known as a frontal lobectomy or leucotomy. It was a fashionable treatment at the time for schizophrenia and was supposed to turn agitated, hallucinating schizophrenics into calmer, happier people. The operation involved severing the frontal lobes from the rest of the brain with a specially shaped knife and was completely irreversible. Fortunately, it was rendered obsolete by the development of phenothiazine drugs such as Lagactyl. The lobectomized men were, it seemed to me, some of the worst affected of the patients, dull and apathetic and zombie-like. I was shocked to find, when surreptitiously looking at their notes, that there was no evidence of any kind of follow-up or post-operative assessment. In all the patients who had been lobectomized, there would be a brief note stating, "Suitable for lobectomy for transfer to AMH." The next entry would read, "Return from AMH for removal of black silt sutures in 9 days." And that was it. There might be the occasional entry years later stating, for instance, "Call to see. Fight with other patient. Scalp laceration sutured." But other than the notes made at the time of the patient's first admission to the hospital, usually with an episode of acute psychosis, the medical notes were empty, even though the patients had been in the hospital for many decades. 2 years earlier, a Royal Commission on Psychiatric Care had been established in response to an outcry in the press over accusations of brutality made by a student who, rather like myself, had worked as a nursing assistant in a long-term psychiatric hospital. It was why I was viewed with considerable suspicion by the other hospital staff when I arrived, and it took me some time to persuade them that I was not spying on them. I suspect that some things were kept hidden from me, but I saw little, if any, actual cruelty when I was there. I was surprised one morning, when spooning gruel into an old man's edentulous mouth, to see the nursing officer come into the dining room. He told me that I had the afternoon off, though he gave me no reason. He had brought with him a large laundry bag full of worn but clean old suits, some of them pinstriped, and much underwear. The patients were all doubly incontinent, so he kept them all in pyjamas, as it was easier to change them and keep them clean. But my fellow nurses and I were told that all patients were now to be dressed in suits and underwear. So our poor, demented patients were all dressed up in sagging, second-hand suits and put back in their geriatric chairs, and I went home. When I clocked in for the late shift next day, I found the patients all back in pyjamas and the ward back to normal. "The Royal Commission came yesterday," Vince said to me with a grin. "They were very impressed by the suits. The nursing officer didn't want you around in case you said the wrong thing." Vince was one of the most impressive people I have met in my long medical career. To work on that ward with those hopeless cases, to treat them with such kindness and tact was remarkable. Sometimes he would stand behind one of the babbling, demented, incontinent old men and lean his hands, sleeves of his white coat rolled up, on the high back of the patient's chair. "What's it all about?" he would say with a sigh. "That's what I want to know. What's it all about?" And we would laugh and get on with the day's work, feeding the patients, washing the patients, lifting them on and off the toilet, and eventually putting them to bed for the night. 35 years later, the hospital is still there, but the grounds have been sold and have become a smart golf course. The patients I looked after must have all died a long time ago. "What are you reading?" my colleague asked, seeing that there was a book on my lap. "Something incomprehensible about the brain," I said, "written by an American psychologist who specializes in treating obsessional compulsive disorder with group therapy based on combining Buddhist meditation with quantum mechanics." He snorted. "How fucking ridiculous. Didn't you once do psychosurgery for OCD? It was true. I had inherited the operation from my predecessor, but had been happy to abandon it. It involved making lesions in the caudate nucleus and cingulate gyrus of the frontal lobes, a sort of micro-lobectomy without its awful effects. The psychiatrists told me that the operation really did work. It had all seemed rather like guesswork to me, but recent high-tech functional scanning in OCD shows that these are indeed the areas involved. Psychosurgery was banned by law in California, so a few desperate Californians who had become quite suicidal because they couldn't stop washing their hands, fear of dirt being one of the commonest problems with OCD, used to come to this country for treatment. I remembered how one of them had to put on 3 pairs of gloves before he could touch the pen I handed him for signing the consent form that allowed me to burn a few holes in his brain. As I told my colleague about my experience of psychosurgery, a nurse came into the room. "Mr. Marsh," she said, looking disapprovingly at me as I lay sprawled on the sofa in my theatre pyjamas, "the next patient says his tumour is on right side, but the consent form says for surgery on left." "Oh, for God's sake," I said, "he's got a left parietal tumour and has got left-right confusion as a result. You might like to know it's called Gerstmann's syndrome. He's the last person to ask where to operate. He's been thoroughly consented. I spoke to him myself last night, and the family as well. Just get on with it." "Some people don't think Gerstmann's syndrome really exists," my colleague, who is very knowledgeable about such things, said from across the room. "You must go talk to him," the nurse said. "This is ridiculous," I grumbled as I rolled off the sofa. I walked the short distance to the anaesthetic room, through the theatre where Kobe, the theatre porter, was cleaning up after the first operation, mopping up blood, smeared in ragged lines on the floor. There was the usual pile of rubbish, several £1,000 worth of single-use equipment scattered around the operating table, waiting to be bagged up and sent off for disposal. I pushed through the swing doors to the anaesthetic room, where the old man was lying on a trolley. "Mr. Smith! Good morning," I said. "I gather you want me to operate on the right side of your head."
"Oh, Mr. Marsh, thank you for coming. Well, I thought it was on the right," he replied, his voice trailing off in uncertainty.
"Your weakness is on the right," I said, "but that means the tumour is on the left of your brain. Everything has crossed over, you know."
"Oh," he replied.
"Well, I'll operate on the right side if you want, but would you perhaps prefer me to decide on the side?"
"No, no," he said, laughing. "You decide."
"Well, left side it is then," I said. I left the anaesthetic room. The nurse would now tell the anaesthetist that she was allowed to start the operation. I went back to the red leather sofa. 40 minutes later, the nurse returned to say that the next patient was now anaesthetized, and I sent my junior off to start the case. The junior doctors work such short hours that they are desperate for even the most basic surgical experience, and I feel obliged to leave all of the opening and closing to them, as this is a simple and relatively safe part of brain surgery, even though I would much prefer to do it myself. The intense anxiety I experience when supervising my juniors, however, so much greater than when I operate myself, means that I find it quite impossible to leave the theatres when they are operating on anything but the simplest cases,
and there is far too much paperwork to bring up from my office, so I feel compelled instead to stay in the room with the red leather sofa. I will wander in and out of the theatre and watch a little jealously what they are doing, and only scrub up when the patient's brain is reached and the operation becomes more intricate and dangerous. The point at which I take over will depend on the experience of the trainee and the difficulty of the case.